On today's College Football Acquirer, Big Ten Commissioner Tony Petitti speaks. That doesn't happen very often. He talked a variety of subjects. Paying the players more. Capping it. Possible? Maybe not. Also, why the Big Ten wants a 2014 playoff and why a 16 is not an option for that league. Also, Coach O won a national title at LSU. He is back on Lane Kiffin's staff in Baton Rouge. We'll talk about it all in the College Football Inquirer. This is College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger. I am Andy Staples. Stephen Godfrey is off. Ross, you are home. You've been at Big Ten meetings and a very wide-ranging conversation with Big Ten Commissioner Tony Petitti on Tuesday night that you guys had. And I am fascinated because we have a lot of directions we can go with this because they are sort of the epicenter of everything right now. And I'm fascinated because you led off the week with a story talking about the Big Ten and the SEC maybe needing to break away from everybody else because there are rules that they would prefer to see changed and the other leagues would prefer to see actually enforced. And so you got to see all of this, Tony Petitti talking, Iowa State AD Jamie Pollard sounding off, telling him to just leave. What was the mood there among the Big Ten folks?
Yeah, the Pollard quote certainly got out pretty good at Big Ten meetings and found its way into the actual meeting room. It was talked about by Tony Petitti during one of the meetings on Tuesday, and I think again on Wednesday. So that was interesting. There's a lot going on, and Petitti talked for roughly an hour. There were about 8 to 10 media members there, and he doesn't talk a lot publicly, but he went a whole hour and touched on a range of subjects. I'd say 40% of the time was spent on the playoff, which playoff format, which I feel like we're all exhausted of writing and talking about. It just is like this endless thing that is like sort of been entrenched in college football for like 20 years of expansion. Are we going to expand? What are we going to do next? And then I would say, 10 to 20 of the remaining minutes or so were spent on the situation going on in Congress and with the College Sports Commission as well, which really, I know the playoff gets the attention, gets the clicks, gets the readership and all that, and everybody loves to talk about the playoff, but the situation with the CSC and the millions of dollars that are right now hung up in the system, I think is a real, real, real big concern for people. And there's fear that, players' NIL deals are not going to get paid because they are hung up in the system. And so the system has to change, right? And that's what he spent time talking about, Andy, is how the system can change, why it has to change. I mean, he had some pretty jarring quotes, including basically we have to find a way to get the student athletes what we want them to get as far as pay. We have to change the system in a variety of ways. And there are a lot of talks there. We can get into the details about how to change the enforcement entity, but as you mentioned, the breakaway, one of the changes would be, hey, you know what? We're just going to like do our own self-governance and self-enforcement, which the SEC, of course, has talked about for years. And I think the Big Ten is touching on as well.
Well, and that's the reason why you talk about this before you would even talk about the playoff, because if the structure of how everyone's organized changes, the structure of the CFP doesn't matter because all of that stuff changes too. And this is interesting to me. I was talking to somebody who works in college sports in kind of a tangential form, but sort of touches all these schools last night. And their question was this: why did these people bother creating the CSC? Why did they do the house settlement the way they did if they knew they were never going to actually follow a cap? What was the point of all that?
That's a good question. And one that Jamie Pollard had mentioned, right? As part of his viral quote was, hey, like they wanted to, you know, we as the four of us wanted to do this, construct it, but led by the SEC and Big Ten because they lead everything, right? Because they are sort of the most valuable assets that college football, college sports has. And so they led this sort of move, and it's really, really costly, right? I think it's upwards of already probably upwards of like $50 million in cost just to run it, operate it, and to start it. Yeah, it's a lot of money. And it's you know, the schools are all chipping in. But you know how ridiculous is, we've talked about this on the pod. I think I mentioned it earlier because a few ADs ended up calling me about it because they didn't realize. But Andy, I mean, the Nebraska arbitration case, look at that. Nebraska was funding their players to fight the CSC. Also, they were funding the CSC to fight right. their players. This is like the bizarre situation that we're in right now. But to get back to your question of why they did it, I think they did it because the vast majority of them, when they're in the room together, are like, we need rules. We need a cap. We're going to follow rules. We're going to do it. And then when they go back to campuses, right, it changes, and it changes in a competitive environment where you're just trying to outbid everybody. So now the rules don't matter.
It's so funny. I was talking to a coach not long ago, and I say this a lot. Like, nobody loves middlemen like college sports. Nobody loves to pay people who don't actually do anything to help the enterprise like college sports, and they can't help themselves. So they get a system where they pay the players, but they have to create more middlemen, and that's what the CSC is. And this coach was like, it's not just that. So they're using the MMR, the multimedia rights companies, Playfly, Learfield. They're using that to funnel money to the players. And the coach is like, why do they get a cut? Like, why can't I just the whatever 10%, 15%, 20% they take?
Yeah.
Why can't I just pay that to the players?
Yeah, and one MMR, it's at least 15%. So you can imagine if one school is spending, let's say, you know, let's go the high route, like Texas, Tennessee, some of these bigger schools that their MMRs are probably worth 10, 20, 30, 40 million a year, and they're taking a portion of that. So let's even just say half, $10 million. Well, the MMR is getting roughly $2 million just from one school. Off the top.
So I'm gonna help everybody increase their payrolls. You get rid of all this BS stuff that doesn't actually help you and isn't actually doing anything. And you can just pay that money to the players if you'd like. I mean, it's easier. But to your point, yeah, I think you're right. I think they when they're in the room together, there's esprit de corps, and it's, we have to do something about this, and everybody's like-minded. And I just remember Ross talking to, you talked to ADs in the same conference before the House settlement started. And some of them would be like, well, we got a cap coming. It's going to be great. We're going to have order and rules. And then the other ones would be like, there's no cap. I don't care. I know there's no cap. My coach is going to blow right through this. And I how could they not figure that out before it all started?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of them didn't know it, right? I remember when this was going on last summer and or last spring, reporting about everything that was coming and the new enforcement entity. And the reaction was sort of like one group that was very excited. Yes, we're going to have rules, and this is going to be, it's going to change everything, right? We're all going to sign this participant agreement. We're going to lock in. And then there was a group that's like, come on, this has never worked. Like, we've tried to do this multiple times. It's never worked. And oh, by the way, I think there's a good amount of schools that are not going to sign that agreement that waives their right to sue. So how is this going to work? And so there were these two sort of camps, and obviously the latter camp was right, and it just not working. So the big question, Andy, and it was a question at And to be clear, we talked a little bit about it after my story ran on Tuesday. We talked about the money. Mm-hmm. The money's even bigger than I reported. I mean, it's even bigger because, I mean, every day there's new deals, right? Every week there's new deals. Those numbers were 2 weeks old. So now we're looking at that there is well over, from what I understand, $250 million that have been submitted since January in the portal by the power conferences. for NIL above the cap pay, well over $250 million. And there is, and if you do the numbers from the CFC, if you take that $250, Andy, and you look at what the CSC has released in January and what it released 2 weeks ago as far as money that's been through the system, it's around, you know, I think they've reported around 100 or 110 million that have been cleared through the system since January. What does that leave you with? 160 million dollars that either has rejected or is still in the system. That is a problem. People are not, players are not getting paid. So there needs to be changes. What are the changes? Well, out of Big Ten land, they want to, a portion of the deals that are currently in the system, that 150 million or so, they want to be cleared, or a lot of them to be just be automatically cleared. And you kind of start over, you blow up the system, you start over, you increase the cap, you have a luxury tax, you go to Kessler and Berman, the plaintiff attorneys, and say, hey, is there a way we can include MMR and sponsorship money, any associated entity deal, into the cap, but raise it? Like, there's all these things being talked about, and I don't know where it ends, but I know this: the SEC, Big Ten think one thing, Big 12 and ACC think another. Andy,
do they not understand that any cap is illegal?
Yeah, well, I mean, they say it's not illegal because it's within a federal injunction, right? It's within the settlement, so they say it is legal.
Yeah, until somebody who's not party to the settlement challenges it.
Well, yeah, and every year, right, there's an opportunity for a new class to come in and challenge that, and I'm sure we'll see that this coming August or so, and we're seeing it now, right? There's an appeal right now going on. Mm-hmm. It's still active, which means, by the way, so a couple things. Not only we have all that 150 plus million that's in the system kind of stuck in there, we have that. Nobody's getting the back pay right now because the back pay's frozen because there's an appeal going on. I'll go back to Jerry Moorhead, the Georgia president's quote in my story on Monday. It's been nothing short of a disaster.
It's true. And when $250 million worth of deals hung up, I will quote someone who actually figured prominently in an NCAA enforcement case. The great Faison Love, not Faison Brandon, not the freshman quarterback at Tennessee. Faison Love. He played a character called Big Worm in a movie called Friday. And he said, Smokey, playing with my money is like playing with my emotions. And that's what they're doing right now. They're playing with everybody's money and they're playing with their emotions. And that's never going to end well. Like when you said, we're going to give you this amount of money, and you're not capable of sending that check, that is a stress on the players. That is a stress on the schools who have promised the money. Is a straight, and you can say, well, the schools knew better, but do you know better when everybody's doing it?
And Andy, to be clear, like to that 250 number, which is over 250, was submitted in January, but only about 150 of that remains in the system. So there's been about 100 to 120 million cleared.
Yeah,
is what the CSC released those numbers, like 115, I think. But still, right, that's a lot of money in the system. And I'm gonna tell you, right when I landed yesterday from LA, I got a call from a AD who I would say is at a Blue Blood program, who had just read my latest story that dropped from LA. Mm-hmm. And the first words out of his mouth were, we got to find a way to pay these players. I mean, it is, I can't, describe enough like how big of this is an issue and how it can result in something really bad that college sports doesn't want. So what to do is a big question, because the Big 12 and ACC, like Pollard said, right, Andy, is sitting there like, wait, you agreed on these rules. You should have guaranteed all this money to players that couldn't get through the cap. We didn't do that, right, at Iowa State. We didn't do that at Kansas. We didn't do that at
Wake
Forest, whatever.
But they did it at Texas
Tech,
and they did it at Miami. So
they did. There's a few of those schools.
What's with the holier than thou from those leagues?
Yeah, no, there's a couple of schools in each of those leagues, right, that are in a similar position to some of the schools in the Big Ten and SEC. There's no doubt about that.
And that's, like, you wrote about the breakaway. And this is what fascinates me, because I keep saying, why are we talking about the playoff when you guys don't even know how you're going to be structured in the next 10 years?
Yeah.
And I the more I think about it, the more it feels to me like there probably, if there was a logical separation, which there would never be a logical separation, but it would be those willing and capable of paying and those not willing and capable of paying at a certain level. Like, that would be the ideal way to do it is here's how much it's going to cost you if you want to be part of this thing. If you can do that, great. If you can't, have your own subdivision.
Yeah, and Andy, you know, one of the things we didn't mention, which I know we talked about, though, on Tuesday is 80%, 75 to 80% of the money submitted, that 250 plus million, is from the SEC and Big Ten. So the illustration of the gaps in the finances between among the leagues has never been more clear. And I think that is going to that when you hear breakaway, when you hear self-governance model, whatever, that if they can't agree on steps forward with the CSC so that the Big Ten and SEC can pay its players, then I think there will be some kind of, well, we got to go our separate way and govern and enforce our own rules over here. Now, how that would work and all the intricacies of that, man, it's complicated. I think the SEC is a little further down the road on that because they've been talking about it forever, as you know, Andy. Well, and now there's real work being put behind it. Here's the thing about
this that I want to ask you, because you've talked to the folks at the SEC about this, but they want to set their own rules. So they want to set their own cap. None of them are going to follow that cap either. We have 100 years of history in SEC football that tells you the rules are merely guidelines.
That is right. Think of it like this. The participant agreement hasn't been signed by, well, the SEC all signed it right back in June.
Right.
And nobody else would sign it. And so far, you know, not everybody has signed it. And it only works if everybody signs it. So
theoretically,
if you're going to break away
like that among
you could,
schools within
among
their own
your league, among your conferences, your conference members only. Correct. That's what I was getting at. But do you trust everybody in the conference to sign something like that? Because they're not doing it now. So why would they do it if you did a self-governance
model?
Well,
that's the thing. I think they're scared of tyranny. They're scared of somebody or a lot of them are scared of someone actually enforcing the rules on them. So, it's the rules are all fine and good until you want to punish me, has been the attitude throughout history of college sports. So, the Big Ten
TJ asked a good question. I think probably there might be some confusion from people. Yeah, people like listening when they're like, wait, there are $40 million rosters and it's over 250 million have been submitted. It's probably more like 270, 280 since January. But only that much has been submitted when there are $40 million rosters. How does this doesn't make any sense. Remember, this is just the above the cap NIL. The 20 million in rev share each school has doesn't have to be submitted to the CSC, the NIL.
Correct.
Bill. So that's also it's only, just the above the cap.
Right? Yeah, we're also only 5.5 months into the year.
Yeah,
there
right,
will be
right,
more
right.
submitted as we go because the contracts stretch out over the year. So
yeah, I mean, and if you took, say it's 280 million, I don't know the exact number, right? It's over 250, but let's say 280. Let's just say that 280 have been submitted and above the cap since January till May 7th was the end date 2 weeks ago. So during that stretch, 280 million or so. All right, so if you divide 280 by 68. Because there's 68 power conference schools, that's $4 million in above the cap spending on average. Well, the average is going to be more than that, obviously. It's probably more like 8 to 10 million. And then if you're in the Big Ten and SEC, it's probably like 15 to 20 million, right? So we're only, as you mentioned, we're only halfway through the year. And, you know, and all deals aren't submitted. We don't have even basketball deals in. Really right now, or a lot of them. So it's only going to get more and more and more, and it's only going to get more difficult and more difficult for programs to get these deals through, which is why everybody's thinking about, we got to change the system. It's not working.
Yes, and that change is going to have to come fairly quickly because June 10th is the hearing for the complaint that the plaintiffs have made about the situation.
That could really NMR change. Company. That could be a change, right?
I mean, think about that essentially blows it all up.
Right. Yeah. It just uncaps the market. But I think the people, even at the Big Ten and SEC, to a degree, want some kind of cap. So how can they establish that?
See, problem with it completely, Ross. Like, I would love to go to the Big Ten people and the SEC people, just kind of shake them a little bit and say, guys, your actions tell us you don't actually want a cap. You can keep saying it, but you keep proving by your actions you don't want one. So just don't have one.
Yeah. Like, and hey, there's been some ADs that have said that publicly. Remember back in January at the national championship
side of
Miami, Radakovich said it pretty flatly. Ross Bjork has said it to a degree. And so in Notre Dame, Pete Bavakwa has said it. Now, look at those three schools, right? They probably have the biggest above the cap NIL spending.
Oh, the Yankees and the Dodgers don't want a salary cap? What a shock.
Yeah, they're probably in the top five of the, those three are probably in the top five of spending on at least on football rosters. So keep that in mind as they say, we don't want a cap.
this works throughout life. Like, don't listen to what somebody says, watch what somebody does. They don't want a cap. They can say it all they want. They don't actually want one. And that's what drives me crazy.
Well, now, Andy, too, I know we're going to move on real quick, but like now, too, you're to the point where the amounts are getting so high and they're going to keep on getting high that if you don't do anything before the next portal, and Petitti said this yesterday, the next portal, the football portal in January, is sort of like D-Day. Like, it's like that if you get there, stuff's going to go up to a degree where you're not going to be able to like really change a lot. Right. If you want to eventually collectively bargain or whatever, like you got to change their deadline is way before the portal. But like if you get to the portal and this isn't changed, it's going to be pretty wild. You're not going to be able to change it at that point.
I really look forward to everyone overspending on quarterbacks and left guards. Can't wait, because that's what's going to happen. When we come back, we will talk about the other prong of this, which is the college football playoff, which is the situation that the Big Ten and SEC are at major odds over. We just heard from Tony Petitti at the Big Ten. Ross and I are both going to the SEC meetings in Destin next week. We will compare and contrast where those two leagues are at on the CFP, because something has to happen on that as well. We'll be right back. We are back at the College Football Inquirer. Ross Dellinger has just returned from Big Ten meetings out in California. Tony Petitti spent a lot of time talking about the College Football Playoff. He has been the one pushing the 2014 playoff. The Big Ten has been behind that one. And it's crazy, Ross, because I was trying to think back to a year ago. The Big Ten was still at 16 a year ago, but one of the automatic bids. And then they shifted to 24 during the fall at some point. And then they were, you know, basically blocked out. Every other league wanted something different. They wanted mostly at-larges. They wanted 12 or 16. And then the Big Ten, after the January meeting in Miami Beach, came out and said, you know what? We could do 24 at-large. And suddenly, everything shifted. So Tony Petitti, speaking from a position of strength, this time, instead of in January, where everybody was just looking at him in a very mean way in the meeting room, how does he feel about the playoff deliberations right now?
Well, he was pretty clear that they are not budging on their position, right? It's 24 or bust. He was asked directly if he would be willing to go to 16 for a couple of years, which they had thought about. Remember, and they were trying to strike a compromise. The SEC and the other leagues, when everybody was behind 16 back just 4 months ago, except for him, they were trying to convince him to go to 16 for a couple of years and then go to 24. And he did really want to do that. And the SEC didn't necessarily want to guarantee that it would go to 24 in like 4 years. So he talked about that and he said, no, right? No, it's going to stay at 12, but it's going to go to 24. And he was pretty clear on that.
His reasoning for that is sound, by the way. I'm a stay at 12 guy, but his reasoning is sound, because 16 is this purgatory where your conference championship games are completely worthless at 16, but you don't have the extra weekend of playoff to sell and then recoup your money.
Right. So like Yeah, at 16, you know, he believes at least you can't have conference championship games even at 16. The coaches don't want to play in them and they have lost their value. So you have to get rid of them, which is $200, $250 million for all of them combined. That's the value that you would lose. And yeah, you can't recoup that in a 16-team playoff. Because remember, a 16-team playoff, I think, adds two games.
Five games.
Okay. Wouldn't it be four?
There's 11 now. I'm sorry, four games.
Okay.
There's 11 now. There would be 15 and 6. Yeah.
Two of those games are owned by ESPN.
Correct.
So then you're selling two games. That obviously isn't going to be worth $200 million.
Which nobody's going to bid on ESPN would then buy on the cheap. I mean, and the Fox, Fox and ESPN at all are hanging over this. So let me reset for the folks. Fox, network partner of the Big Ten. Big Ten also has games on NBC and CBS, but it is Fox that actually owns the rights to them all and then sublicenses them to the other league, to the other networks. So it is really Fox in control here. And then obviously the ESPN and Disney own the SEC's rights. And so that is where you have probably the biggest conflict. ESPN does not want to go past 16 for the reasons I just gave you. They don't want Fox to be able to get into this. And I thought Stuart Mandel had a great column, and I actually spun off of this for a column that I wrote it on 3 that came out Thursday. Fox is doing this in part. Fox gave it, you know, had a very depending on who you talk to, they either didn't bid or just had a really unserious bid the last time around.
Mm.
It was such an unserious bid that it may as well not have been a bid.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've heard too. And I don't know if they actually made an official bid or it was just so low, like you mentioned. But whatever it was half or less of what ESPN paid, which is $1.3
and so
billion.
I've been told, the way it was explained to me is, you know, Disney has been televising the college football playoff. It is a budget line for them. They obviously expected the price to go up for the current deal. So they had everything, all their ducks in a row. Fox would have had to reallocate lots of money from different places. At the time this was all going on, they just agreed to the $775 million settlement with Dominion, the voting machine company that had sued Fox News. And so there was a lot going on at the time that probably made it difficult for them to allocate a huge amount of money to try to go get the college football playoff. So they didn't get into it. Now they want into it. There's also a matter of, and we've talked about this on the show, like when I play the Guess the Big Noon game on week one, like that has a very real consequence for Fox that those games stink. And they're looking at what they're getting from the Big 12 and the Big 10 early season. It's not great. And it's so their thing is, let's buy, if they're not going to give us good games, because they can't change the contract, they can't force them to give them better games. So if they're not going to give us good games early, let's buy good games late.
Well, buy good games late also, Andy, and expand the playoff enough to where it incentivizes bigger non-conference games.
I don't believe them.
I know, but they believe it will. But I think there is some doubt in that. Like, you know, and I've talked to ADs, and you probably have too, of like, well, just because the playoffs expanded doesn't mean we want to take another loss.
Yeah, they like, tripled the size of the field 2 years ago, and everybody decided they needed to cancel good games more than they did before.
The only answer to the scheduling thing is a universal schedule that's created by some neutral entity or party or commissioner of college football that makes a universal schedule. And by the way, I dropped this little nugget in here. You know, at Big Ten meetings, they talked about playing 10 conference games. And I think there are going to be some other leagues talking about 10 conference games too, because it just increases the value. If you are going to not schedule good non-conference games, force your league members to go ahead and play.
Which is what the SEC went to 9. Like, everybody thinks the SEC went to 9 because the Big 10 and the Big 12 complained about it. That had nothing to do with it. They went to 9 because they wanted better games to sell.
Now, that's only 10 conference games is only on the table if you go to 24-team playoff, right?
Correct.
It's got to be a 24-team playoff.
And what I suggested in the column is, instead of that, which is fine, if you want to do that and then require one power conference, non-conference game, so you're up to 11, okay, that's fine. But I would prefer more data points across conferences. So require have nine conference games, but then require two power conference opponents per year out of conference. You get much better schedules that way. You get much more interesting schedules that way. And look, if y'all want to make them all neutral site games and funnel the money to NIL, okay, do that. Like, it's all out there for you. But that the only thing about that, Ross, and this is one thing I couldn't get into in the column, you still probably have to give the group of six a spot in the playoff.
Yeah.
And then you're actually actively shutting, if you do this, you're actively shutting them out of scheduling power conference teams.
That's true. You're definitely limiting the amount of games played against them. But yeah, you're right about the G6 right there. According to the MOU, they've got to give them a spot. And Tony Petitti finally, like, publicly somebody said that, and it was Petitti on Tuesday night when he was speaking to us, is that he said, hey, like, the G6 are getting their automatic.
That's the bid. It's a tax. It's like every industry probably has some regulation, government regulation they have to deal with. This is the tax to keep them from suing you on antitrust grounds. Like, that's the tax.
Yep. And I think everybody's willing to pay it for now. It would be curious of how the years turn here and a new CFP deal, if that continues, and if the financial we're talking about in the first segment, the financial disparities between the two and the other two. Mm-hmm. Imagine the financial disparities between the four, and the six, and sort of, or in the two and the six, right? And how that looks. It's
yeah. And I wonder if it changes how people in the group of six feel. Because I remember talking to Spencer Danielson, the Boise State coach, last season, and we asked him that, because this is when, the idea was bubbling up of just a group of five. It was a group of five back then. Now the Pac-12 is back, so it's a group of six. But of a group of five playoff that existed separately from the CFP. And he's like, absolutely not. We don't want that. We want to go challenge for the big thing. Our fans don't want that. Our administration doesn't want that. But I do wonder, as this goes further and the gap does increase, do they start to think, you know what, maybe this would be better? I don't know that. And I would love an answer from the folks at say Boise State, at USF, at Tulane, at the people where they do really still want to compete at that level.
Yeah. I'm going to be fascinated. We can pivot a little bit to the conversation that's going to unfold in Destin at SEC meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A lot happening there. And the CFP is certainly going to be one of the agenda items. I don't think it's going to be number one, number two, or maybe even number three, because remember, in mid-June is the next time the CFP commissioners meet in person, and that's when they'll probably get evaluation on what the additional, like the 2014 playoff, will be valued at in the media market, and if it's worth doing it. So we won't know that necessarily next week. We'll have some better idea, because I think the CFP is going to actually be CFP Rich Clark in a few people that's on his staff and the CFP media consultants, I think, will all be in Destin. So we could have a better idea of what the valuation maybe is. But look, there, it's going to be the same conversation. The agenda items that led the Big Ten are going to be similar to the at the SEC meetings, which is breakaway stuff, self-governance and CFP or CSC and the situation around all that. I think there'll be similar discussion points there. But I had in my story Tuesday night a little line buried in there, but the SEC ADs met 2 weeks ago in Birmingham, and while I think a lot of the room would prefer to go to a 16-team playoff before it goes higher than that, I think they want 24 more than they want to stay at 12, which makes sense, and is something to keep in mind as you go forward on these conversations. They need more access. They like more money, but they really just need more access because of how much they are spending on their rosters.
And that is, by the way, exactly what Jim Phillips, in the ACC said. That's the same thing that he said he got from all his ADs. I thought, so our friend Seth Emerson from The Athletic talked to Greg Sankey about a week ago, and there was an answer in that Q&A that I thought was interesting, because it felt like to me that Greg had softened a little bit on the idea of 24, provided the money was there to make them whole for if they had to get rid of their championship game. And that was less hardline than I think I'd seen from him.
I didn't. What did he say exactly? I'd be curious. I missed that.
He just said, he said he'd listen, which is not something that you know, but they also, because again, ESPN and Fox hang over all of this. They're going to work to protect their partner. And the ACC didn't. The ACC is with ESPN and has gone against them. But the SEC and ESPN's relationship, I feel like, is a little bit different. I've joked often that if you go on Disney Plus, they have the five boxes across the top. There's Darth Vader, and then there's Captain America. And then the next one should be Nick Saban, because basically the Disney company, like the SEC, is kind of crucial to ESPN's survival as an ongoing entity.
Yes.
Like the NFL and the SEC are probably their two most important partners. And I say that as they are about to televise the NBA finals. So I think the SEC is going to go to the wall to protect ESPN in this playoff thing. Cause if it does go to 24, I don't think ESPN has the cash to buy those extra games, nor the desire.
Well, I think too, you know, you look at like how much are they really worth? I mean, because I know we talked about this before. Like when you look at what the matchups would be, you're basically buying the 8 first round games, and you're buying 2 of the second round games, and you know they're anywhere from Vanderbilt against Virginia, Texas, SMU,
Miami, Iowa was the one Miami, I think it would have been. Yeah, like that would have been. But that's the sexiest one of the ones that would have been.
Right.
And that's not that sexy.
Yeah. And you talk to media people, and they'll tell you that it's, you know, some of these games are worth 5 to 10 million. Others are worth 20-ish million. So if you find the middle number, maybe they're worth 15 million, 15 to 20-ish.
Now, there's also gate receipts and that sort of thing that matter, too, because these tend to be fairly big stadiums since they're college football
stadiums.
There's
an extra 12 home games, right? Extra 12 home games that you get. But 15 times, you know, 10 is 150 million, and that's not enough. But if you add in the gates and things like that, maybe you can get it up to the 250, 300 mark. But in order to also something like missing, you don't have to just make it up, right? They don't want to just make up that 250 million.
They want to make more.
They want to make more because, of course, they just want it in their pocket, obviously, in a time of financial stress with athlete pay. But they also want the value of the CFP to remain high. They don't want to water it down. And that's a big thing, like the media consultants, I think, told the room when they went in there like a month ago during meetings in Dallas, CFP meetings in Dallas. The media consultants were like, hey, we haven't even started the first year of this new 6-year deal, and we're already going to devalue the entire playoff by adding games worth so much level. The idea is to wait. You want to wait a little bit before you would do this.
To my point, if you stay at 12, which is something that Tony Petitti and Greg Sankey have both said they would be fine with rather than go to the thing they don't want to go to, if you stay at 12 and add more games like, oh, I don't know, Miami-Notre Dame, Notre Dame-USC, you know, Texas and Ohio State, which is being played this year, Oklahoma and Michigan, which is being played this year. Like, I don't know, Penn State's not playing any power conference, non-conference games. How about Penn State, Texas Tech? I'd watch the hell out of that. Penn State, Florida, Penn State, Auburn. They played that a few years ago. It was great. So those games probably add more value at the beginning of the season than these other ones would at the end. But those deals are already made. You really can't get more for them unless, well, unless you do the neutral site thing. Then you can get them to negotiate a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So. You can, right? We talked about that, right? I mean, a neutral site game can, you know, a regular home game, you talk to an AD, like a power conference AD, right? It's going to turn like 2 to 4 to maybe 6 million, but these neutral site games can go upwards of like 8 million.
Yeah. I learned it when the Jacksonville Jaguars announced that they were going to completely renovate their stadium and it was going to require the Jags to be away from home for a year, for 2 years, which meant Florida and Georgia were going to have to find somewhere to play their game. My initial thought was, this will be back on campus like it was in 94 and 95. And then I started calling people from Florida and Georgia. They're like, there's no way it's going on campus. Do you know how much we make off this game as a neutral site game?
Yeah.
And sure enough, there was the bidding war began immediately for those 2 years.
Yep.
So that's that. But that's what the SEC's got to work out. I would love if they would just stay at 12, try to front load the schedule a little more, and just accept that, hey, you're not all going to make the playoff. But I don't think that's realistic. Because like you just said, the SEC ADs aren't any different from the ACC ADs, aren't any different from the Big Ten ADs. They want to be in the thing.
Yep. More access, you know, and Petitti said it, you know, the investment that our league schools are making needs to meet the increase in access, increase in investment, increase in access. So I'm sure we'll hear that.
We want a participation trophy because we paid all this money.
Basically, right. They don't want to, this was a conversation definitely out there in LA. It was, I was having it with one of the athletic directors out there was, you know, we spent $30 million on a roster. We don't want to go to the Citrus Bowl anymore for that. We want to be the number 19 seed in the playoff and have a chance at the national championship.
It's so funny because I was reading, I think it was Bud Elliott from CBS was saying how much the playoff has devalued, you know, the different bowls and how meaningful a trip to the Citrus Bowl used to be. And I'm like, buddy, Steve Spurrier said it in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Can't spell citrus without UT. Tennessee fans knew that was an insult. Like everybody's known. And I think it's, you know, look, if you ain't first, you're last. So
yeah.
Should we really be arguing about whether you're 13 through 24? I don't know. But that is what we're going to do for the next God knows how long. Ross, when we come back, a familiar face returning to a familiar place. Coach O headed back to Baton Rouge where he was fired. Just 4.5 years ago. We'll talk about it when we come back. We are back on the College Football Inquirer, and Ross, I want to take you back to the place you once covered as a beat writer. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the Red Stick. LSU has rehired Ed Orgeron. He is going to take a place on Lane Kiffin's staff at LSU. And he now becomes the third fired LSU head coach to be reemployed by LSU in the last 3 months.
What do they say, Andy? The SEC loves it. Some SEC, how all the coaches just cycle through. LSU loves it. Some LSU, man. Come on back. Johnny Jones, assistant basketball coach they fired in 2017. Will Wade, basketball coach they fired in.
Yeah, Johnny Jones is the head coach, and he's back as an assistant.
Yeah. And then obviously Ed Orgeron in 2021, they fired.
Yeah, 2021.
So, yeah, three coaches in really less than 10 years. That was within a span of a decade. You know, it's funny. The backstory with, from what I understand, with Ed Orgeron was. He moved from Miami. He had moved to Miami. His son or sons, I can't remember if they're both down there. I think they are. They're both in Miami on staff. And he moved down there, you know, several months ago, maybe several years ago. And then he moved in
December.
He could
see J-Lo's house from his condo, he told us.
Yeah, there you go. He moved in December to Baton Rouge. He moved back to Baton Rouge thinking that he'd have a place on Lane Kiffin's staff in some role. And it didn't happen immediately, but eventually happened. What do they say when you're there, right? Just be there in person, and something will happen. And I think something was going to happen either way, whether he was hired on the football staff or hired at the university in some, you know, TAF, which is their foundation. Yeah, I mean, because look, the people of Louisiana LSU seem to love Ed Orgeron, right? I mean, I know the last 2 years weren't great, with his last two seasons, but it doesn't really matter because he won a national championship, potentially with the best team that college football has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And so I think forever he's going to be and he's one of them, and he talks like a lot of them. So like he's just the beloved figure there. And it's just what's going on in Baton Rouge, whether it's coaches or the athlete compensation or, you know, all the changes, the governor's involvement. I mean, holy, it's wild.
It is amazing. And you covered that program during a period of pretty seismic change in that program, because you had Joe Oliva, yeah, who was running the program. By the way, I think history has been really kind to Joe Oliva. I think history has vindicated Joe, yeah, Oliva on a lot of things. And he has not done a lot of public I told you so's, though he probably could. History has not been so kind to Scott Woodward, who's the AD who replaced him, who was the AD who fired Ed Orgeron and fired Will Wade. And it feels like the last 6 months have just been a repudiation of Scott Woodward, who like the wrong, if you're Scott Woodward, the wrong guy got elected governor, essentially, for you to continue on. And Scott Woodward was always a political animal, which means there was always a risk of if a guy was elected governor who didn't like you, you had a real problem.
Yep. It's it's that place is as political as I've ever seen anywhere. Not just LSU and LSU athletics, but obviously just the state politics in the state. And you know, you're right in the capital city, and you're the only power conference school in the state. When I was there, so I was 10, this was probably 10 years ago, I did a, the old public records request to see what kind of money that the football program made. And I think 1 year, the football program's profit was $55 million. Now, I can't imagine like what it is, but what I'm going to say all that to say that the football program there feels like a pro program. And it probably feels like the same at Ohio State in Texas, right? University of Texas. There are these places where they're sort of dropped in these cities without a professional team or so, and they've just become this behemoth. And now we're seeing LSU, the difference with LSU in those places I just mentioned is it's in one of the poorest states in America, and it's spending all this money. And so there's a lot of people asking, people don't ask the question of like, how is Texas spending all this money? How's Ohio State spending all this money? How's USC or Miami? People know how they're getting the money, right? They have tons of donors. They have tons of corporate sponsor type. And not to say LSU doesn't, but it is dropped in a very poor state. And people around the college athletics community are certainly asking, what is going on down there? How are they getting this money?
Well, when the governor is on your side and will rubber stamp everything you want to do. So the Ed Orgeron part's really interesting to me. So Ed Orgeron and Lane Kiffin were assistants together at USC. Mm-hmm. When Lane Kiffin got the Tennessee job, Ed Orgeron had recently been fired from Ole Miss. It had been there was a year gap in between, but he brings Ed Orgeron to Tennessee famously. They together go to USC when Lane takes the USC job. And so these guys have gotten along well, worked together well for a long time. We were hearing when Lane Kiffin was talking to Florida before he ghosted Florida and decided to take the LSU job, that Coach O was probably on the staff day one, if that came to fruition. So it seemed like this was bound to happen sooner or later that these two got back together.
Yeah. And, you know, they're obviously, I remember Lane would tell stories about how he learned how to sort of recruit from Ed Orgeron back in the day, 20 years ago when they were on the USC staff, and how he recruited and how they hosted, you know, those like, there were some of the first people to host the sort of the high school camps or sleepover things. Remember all that?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like they were some of the first ones and they remain, I think they remain pretty close, like through the years, like you said. And now speaking of recruiting, because of the new rules around college football recruiting and the flexibility and freedom that the new rules give non on-field staff members, you know, usually had the 10 or 11, whatever it is now, the assistants, and they could be the only ones to go off campus and recruit. Now everybody can. It's on staff. And so, not everybody, but a certain number, as you still have to stay within a certain number. Well, Ed Orgeron will certainly be, I'm sure, in that number, and he will be able to go off campus and recruit recruit again for the Tigers.
And also probably help on the field as well, which that you can do. Anybody can coach on the field now too. That those rules are gone.
Yep.
And
yeah, that's right.
Ed Orgeron still one of the better D line coaches in college football, and it's interesting because he will be for Lane what Pete Jenkins was for him when Ed Orgeron was at all. Where they bring in Pete Jenkins, who's this, you know, longtime old school respected D line coach, and he was sort of a consigliere. John Robinson, the former USC coach, was another consigliere of Ed Orgeron when he was at LSU. And so that is a role I imagine Ed Orgeron's going to play for Lane Kiffin, because Ed Orgeron has navigated the place before, and he's won a national title at the place before. And ultimately, like, Ross, what is Lane Kiffin's job? It's to win a national title at LSU.
Yep. And yeah, you're right. He knows the landscape better than anybody, and he knows how to win a national championship better than anybody there, because he's done it. And he built, you know, that year in 2019, he built an incredible roster, and a lot has changed, obviously, in that stretch of time. But I'm sure he'll if he hasn't already, he'll get caught up on, you know, hey, you know, you can actually pay the players now. Legally, pay the players.
I think he's pretty well caught. Based on his recent comments, I think he's pretty well caught up on that.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating to see these two work together in that environment versus the old environment. And Lane Kiffin doing something that his predecessor, Brian Kelly, did not. Brian Kelly pushed away all that was LSU initially. My friend Chris Lowe at On3 had a great story on Tommy Moffitt, their former strength coach, who Brian Kelly unceremoniously fired week one. And Tommy Moffitt is now the Texas A&M strength coach, who took great pleasure in emptying out Tiger Stadium in Brian Kelly's final game as LSU's coach last year. So this is Lane also saying, hey, I want to have somebody who can help me navigate as opposed to, I know more than all of you. I can just do this. So there's that part of it too.
Yeah. And we haven't touched on all the other craziness on campus there, obviously.
You mean Will Wade recruiting back 25-year-old, I guess. Like European pros.
That's what happens when you sort of don't have players, right? Remember, there was at one point LSU had zero players on the roster.
They will have to field it. They can actually field a starting five now, Ross.
Yeah. Now, here's the
question. We'll see about the bench.
These players all need a waiver from the NCAA. And many of these players, from what I understand, would not be eligible under what is going to be the new five-year age-based eligibility rule.
Right.
If the NCAA leans on the new rule, uses the new rule in order to grant waivers, these players won't be eligible. So,
wait, they weren't pregnant? Or serving in the military?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, that's not going to work for them. But at least they can rent cars.
Yes, they can. Yeah, it's quite a group. Think of LSU's just staff, coaches in general and on that campus, right? Lane Kiffin, Ed Orgeron, Kim Mulkey,
yep,
Will Wade, Johnny Jones, Rick Stansberry.
I keep forgetting Rick Stansberry is an assistant. For those who don't know, Ross, let us help everybody. Rick Stansberry, yeah, longtime Mississippi State head basketball coach, known for having was it a kid or a grandkid on his lap during press conferences after losses?
His two kids, Noah. Yeah. He named him after all the Bible, you know, the Bible verses, Noah, mm-hmm, Luke, and he used to have them kind of on each arm.
Human shields famously at press conferences. Yes, when he lost games.
Rick Stansberry also, you know, known for something else. He's the most winningest coach in Mississippi State basketball history.
Yes.
But also he had really, really talented players that he got. And if you talk to coaches around the country, they'll say he got them in an illegal form, at least back then.
But now it's all legal. College basketball coaches didn't break the rules, Ross. What are you talking about?
No, never, never, definitely not.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it must be fun to cover Baton Rouge day to day, to be in Baton Rouge day to day and cover that program. I think of the old
back and buy a condo.
Ross, when I was in middle school, you had the t-shirts that would have the caricatures of your favorite team. So you'd have the Chicago Bulls and it'd have, like, you know, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant on there. I just want the caricature t-shirt of the LSU coaching staff. Like, I want Lane Kiffin standing next to Kim Mulkey, standing next to Coach O and Will Wade.
That would be great.
Perfect.
Perfect. I remember when I was covering the team, actually not as a beat writer, but I went back in the national role in, it was probably during COVID, I want to say, and or maybe after, I can't remember. But I walked on an elevator, and then Kim Mulkey walked on the elevator, and then Ed Orgeron walked on the elevator, and I was like, wow.
That's a lot of personality in one elevator.
Yeah, yeah, a lot, yeah. Fun times down in the bayou.
Oh, wow. Ross, on Tuesday, we're going to preview the SEC spring meetings in Destin. We've talked a little bit about what they're going to talk about, but we can delve a lot deeper into it and get more SEC specific. And then you and I will be on the Redneck Riviera. So I will see you there.
Yep.
And we will see you on Tuesday.